Welcome to the Airport Lounge. I'm your host, Airport. This podcast, like the content I read on Twitter, is aimed at providing deeper insights into all things Web3, including the stories of prominent figures, builders, and community members generally operating in this space. My guest today is Fantron, CEO and founder of Ragnarok Meta, an upcoming blockchain-based MMORPG. I first met Fantron when he reached out to me on Twitter discussing the possibility of potentially collaborating on a written piece, which we tabled at the time and didn't pursue further. Sometime after, I did some research into Ragnarok Meta for an AMA I was hosting with Fanfaron, and I was intrigued by him and his project, and wanted to hear his story. I take conflicts of interest and disclosures very seriously. Prior to recording this podcast episode, I asked Fanfaron for a small whitelist allocation for the moderators and the companion Discord server to this podcast. I also want a whitelist for Ragnarok separately, and intend to mint my whitelist allocation at the minimum. As far as I'm aware, Fanfaron is also not publicly doxxed, so if this is something important to you when assessing projects, please do keep this in mind. Finally, nothing in this podcast should be construed as financial advice. Please do your own research fully before deciding to make any investments. And before we get into the podcast, I also want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, Origins NFT. Origins is a data analytics platform and community of NFT traders that I've been a part of since my time entering the Web3 and NFT communities. Owning an Origins NFT pass gives access to the closed Discord, which houses various data and alert tools, threads for in-depth discussions on projects, and in-depth write-ups from community analysts, including myself, for long-term calls and projects we're bullish on. Anyone who's followed me on Twitter for some length of time will have seen me post the occasional Origins chart together with some analysis. I often credit a lot of what I know and understand about markets and data-driven analytics to the Origins community, and truly, navigating the space is made a lot easier with a community of like-minded individuals. I've been a vocal supporter of Origins NFT for the longest time prior to sponsorship of the podcast, and I encourage everyone who's still looking for a community to navigate this space with to pop into the server, have a chat with me or any of the mods in the comments channel, and have a look around. Thanks very much to Origins for sponsoring this podcast, and without further ado, let's hop into today's episode with Fanfaron.
I think we're recording now, so Fanfaron, welcome to the Airport Lounge. How you doing, man?
Hey, Airport. Doing awesome. How about you?
Yeah, good. You know, it's interesting how this whole thing came together, right? I think, you know, you reached out to me a little while ago, and it was interesting because I think at the time, you know, you asked me about potentially doing a write-up for you guys, and I sort of was like, you know, I don't really do that for projects and stuff. But as I sort of, you know, looked into what you were doing and looked into your project and stuff, you know, I got more and more curious. And obviously, we had the chance to interact a little bit after you did the Origins AMA that I was sort of not directly involved with, but on the fringe side of, you know, discussing internally and stuff. And then I did the Sniff one with you. And so I've heard a lot about your project at this point. But yeah, I'm curious to hear more about yourself. So, you know, I'll make you do the intro that you keep doing at all these AMAs, and then we'll sort of go in from there. So, you know, why don't you tell us about yourself first?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a builder. I'm an architect. I graduated from master degree 8 years ago. And then I went to work in China, in Beijing. And after, I mean, we built a tower, and after 4 months of working in there, I decided to quit my job and launch my first company, which was a food tech company. And then after 1 year and a half, we decided to stop because Deliveroo and Uber Eats came in with huge loads of money and we couldn't compete. Then that was end of 2016. I was introduced to crypto back then by some friends. And yeah, bought some Ethereums and Bitcoins. And yeah, I got lucky in 2017. Then cashed out in end of 2017 to launch my second company, which is a biscuit factory. And the biscuit factory is still running now. But in mid-2019, I decided to become passive and just a shareholder to focus on my third company, which I launched right after, which was a direct-to-consumer eyewear brand. And I sold it 9 months ago. When I sold it 9 months ago, I came back into crypto and wanted to become way more involved than just trading. And because I'm a builder. So when I came back, I was seeing this trend of the metaverse and was feeling underwhelmed. And personally, I'm a big gamer. I was a big gamer when I was younger and a big anime fan. So when I was seeing this trend of the metaverse, I was feeling underwhelmed. And that's where I wanted to start Ragnarok.
That's awesome. And I mean, it's interesting, right? Because when you look at the sort of companies that you've been involved with, I mean, you know, a food tech company, being the first one, and then, you know, move to a biscuit factory, which is, I mean, I guess kind of similar, but, you know, very different. And then direct to consumer eyewear, you know, I mean, that's like a big pivot, right? So what kind of what happened there? Like what was the story of how you got into that?
Yeah. So, I mean, the food tech, I mean, I knew nothing about food to start with. I knew how to build buildings. I knew some theories about business. I had lots of experiences of small jobs or small things that I would sell when I was like 13, 14, but I never actually built a business. So that first experience was quite intense. It was like an MBA, to be honest. And so I realized back then that I could do almost anything, in the sense that, I learned a lot about the food on the go. And so I figured out that I was more open-minded and open in terms of my skills of building, whether it's a building or a food tech company. And when I built my second company, which was quite crazy, we built it with my two other co-founders. The biscuit factory was a completely different business. To build a factory, to build an industry, and to hire such—I mean, we have like 60 employees—and to have such an extensive new thing that I mean, nobody would thought that at 20, I was 28, 27, that. I could build a biscuit factory from scratch. So we built the building, we imported the machines, and I saw my capacity of learning new things. That was pretty intense. So biscuit factory was a completely different business. I mean, just the food is the same, but still, I mean, recipes for biscuits are drastically different. It's like chemistry. And then the third business that I did is basically my family is in the eyewear business for the past 20 years. So I grew up in eyewear. I understand eyewear extremely well. And I saw a big opportunity in the market. So I dived deeper and took my experience from the previous companies and just launched it. And it went really well.
That's incredible. And I think it's interesting, right? Because I think, you know, the way that you've described it in the AMAs that, you know, I've been on with you and the ones that I've heard and doing my research and stuff, you know, leading up to this. And you always describe your first startup as, you know, having failed, right? Which I think is very interesting, because I think it also signals, you know, to me, what kind of person you are, right? Because I think people often are afraid of the idea of like saying, oh, you know, this thing failed or it didn't work and stuff, where I think, you know, you're very open about that kind of thing. And that's something that I, you know, as a personal exercise, you know, I quite like to do as well, right? Because I think just have, you know, something failing is not necessarily a bad thing. It's more about what you get out of it. And I think, you know, you sort of saying that it was like an MBA for you and stuff, that makes total sense to me, because I do think, you know, there is an abundance of people in this space who don't really have experience, you know, project managing or sort of running, I guess, an organization. And I think that's actually one of the things that really does come up when you're actually, you know, sort of neck deep in it and doing that on a day-to-day basis, you know?
Yeah, I mean, completely. And I was speaking about this with a friend 2 days ago. And basically, everybody's still learning. If you stop learning, then, you stop growing as a whole. And I think the whole failing and learning stuff and doing different things is just preparing you up to create something even bigger. And I think it's necessary. Like, I would trust, after my experience for the past 8 years trying to build businesses and building businesses, these failures, these repetitive failures, I mean, because there's always failures. Even if they're not big ones, there's always small failures that you need to go over and learn from them. They make you stronger, and they make you understand better things than just theory. Because as human beings, theory is good, but practice is 1,000 times better. Because when you practice something and it doesn't work, and you're still open-minded, and you're trying to understand why it didn't work, then you improve over and over again. It's like when you go at the gym, right? You go, you work out, and then until muscle failure. And then next time, I mean, upon weeks and months, your muscle gets stronger and bigger. And you can, I mean, if you lift like 20 kilograms at the beginning, and you can lift 30, and that 20 seems easy. And it's the same for businesses. The more you fail, small failures, the more you're going to get stronger as a startup founder.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. I think, you know, for me, having worked as a lawyer before, you know, I think the difference is it's so stark between, you know, actually being in practice and sort of running a practice and, you know, doing actual transaction documents versus just, you know, the stuff that we learned in school. So, you know, it is always a thing for me when I'm looking at, you know, talking to people about this kind of stuff. You know, if people think that the education and the theory is everything, you know, it's really not, right? So I definitely do think that there's this massive, you know, thing in the space of people who, you know, do, I guess, lack a bit of that experience. And I do think that, you know, there are people out here trying to get it, which I really respect. And, you know, I always love to see people that are hustling in that way and trying to build up their, you know, credibility, experience, and, you know, just by doing stuff. So I totally get that. Yeah.
Yeah, no, definitely. And honestly, if anything, the experience that I learned for the past 8 years, because for me, like, this is still university. Like, I'm just graduating from university of building a business. And you realize, you know, like Steve Jobs said, the dots are being connected. And you realize that it's all preparing you up for what you're doing now. Like all the learnings and all the experience that you had is just like dots connecting between each other to that leads you to where you are now. Because if I've launched this business 8 years ago, even if the timing was right, me myself, I would not be prepared to lead a team of 35 people and to synchronize and to try to build things in the right way. I would have no experience in marketing. I would have no experience in growth, and it would have just been a whole new experience. Right now, I'm more trained.
I you know, I totally resonate with that. And this was a conversation that I was having with someone the other day too. You know, just talking about that exact experience. You know, I think with me and sort of writing on Twitter and stuff, you know, it's funny because I think about how I got to where I got to just as a content creator. And it's interesting because, you know, when I was in high school, I always thought I was going to go to medical school. That was always sort of my thing. And, you know, so I was a big science guy and sort of, you know, took all the science courses that I could. But then kind of last minute, I thought, you know, I'm not really cut out for medical school because I thought there was going to be a lot of memorization and sort of, you know, it was going to be really tough on that front. And I was always kind of the more analytical guy and not really the sort of, you know, wanting to memorize stuff. So I kind of did like a hard pivot and I didn't really know how to write. So I went to my English teacher's classroom like every day after school, or I guess like 3 days a week out of, you know, after school. And I wrote a past paper in her office, like with her supervision. I did this for a few months. And that was basically just because I needed to learn how to write very quickly. Otherwise, I wouldn't get into law school, you know? And, you know, at the time, it was just something that I did because I had to do it. But when I look back, you know, that sort of laid a lot of the groundwork for, you know, the stuff that I'm doing now where, you know, I write and people often say like, oh, you know, you're a really good writer. And I'm like, damn, you know, it's funny because I never thought of myself that way. But it's like you said, you know, you kind of just prepare yourself by doing these things. And ultimately, when all of that comes together, it's like the past experiences just find a way to sort of work their way into whatever you're doing, you know?
Yeah, completely agree. Completely agree with that.
That's awesome, man. So interesting how, you know, the big transition, obviously, right? So Biscuit Factory, then Consumer Eyewear. And I guess this feels to me almost like, you know, now that you're in this Web3 space, you're almost like pursuing like a passion project of sorts, right? You said you're a big gamer, anime fan, that kind of thing. So, you know, how did this whole idea to create a game like this come about? You know, you've mentioned before that there was a lack of such, you know, products in the space, and it was kind of uninspiring. So what was the thought process that led you to design and build this?
Yeah. So in July, when I sold my company, I came back into crypto, not even looking at NFTs, right? I mean, I was introduced to NFTs in 2017 with CryptoKitties and CryptoPunks back then. I mean, I thought it was like not interesting at all. And then when I came back, I didn't even think about NFTs. I was seeing the coins and whatever was happening. And then I started seeing this trend of the metaverse going. And I dig deeper into it to try to understand what the space all about. And then I figured out that combining the digital experience with ownership could create something that opens up a new dimension of possibilities that was not possible before in the digital world. So then in July, August, I started digging more and more, and I was thinking of the games that I was playing, the MMORPGs that I was playing a lot with my friends when I was younger. Like, I would come back from school when I was 12 years old or 13 years old, and we'd just hang out digitally in those MMORPG spaces, and you can chat with your friends again and go and slay monsters with them, and then you make new friends. And it was a whole social experience combined with fun of killing monsters and evolving and showing that you're the strongest. And I was remembering this. I installed one of the games that I was playing when I was younger, like World of Warcraft, the first versions. And yeah, I played it and it brought back lots of memories. And then I realized that, imagine if combining this social experience with the gaming aspect of an MMORPG, the fun and thrill it gives you with ownership. What if you could own those items in the game? What if you could own those buildings in the game? What if you could own your character? Because back then, lots of people would just sell their accounts and just like make money out of like their grind in gaming and all that stuff. And I figured out that if you own that thing for real, and it's not just living on a server of a game, of a game company, that it, then it could be game changing, because you could create a new world, because you combine all the aspects of what a world is into a digital one. So when I had this idea of combining ownership with the game experience and social experience, I started to dig deeper into what was around. Like, did it exist? Was it even possible? So from July till end of September or beginning of October, I just dig deeper and try to understand what was a game really? How do you build a game? What was a game design document? What kind of team members did you need? Is it even possible to link blockchain and gaming, because no one has done it? How can you create something that is fun without skewing a game economy? Because one of the other passions of mine is finance. Like, I'm not a finance guy, but I love numbers. I'm really easy with numbers. So I was trying to figure out, like, is it possible? Is it even possible? So it took me 3 months to figure out that it might be possible and that there was nobody else building it out there. Because on one side, there was those P2E games that were not fun to play. And on the other side, there was those wannabe AAA games that are trying to build a game like you would build a game on PlayStation, you know, build for 2-4 years and then put out the product and then you're done. And the way I thought of things was to build it continuously for 10, 20 years and to bring something that constantly evolves with the world. It's not something that is fixated and then it's finished. It's not a polished product, but it's a constantly evolving product, like a social network of Facebook or whatever. And so, yeah, I just went to it. I put my money where my mouth was, from the money I earned from my first company, for the company I just sold. And there I started.
That's incredible. I mean, so I want to dive into a couple of things here. So, I mean, first of all, you know, what did you sort of find in terms of, you know, who you need as a team sort of to, you know, to make mm-hmm. this come to life? Because I think that's one of the things that is most mind-boggling to people who are outside of it, you know, and even, I guess, for yourself, like even just thinking about the idea, like, you know, how do you even get started with something like this, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I had my best friends who were in the space in gaming, one of my best friends. Who was in gaming, and I had another friend, a close relative, who was in blockchain development, like in Solidity development. And so I had up conversations with them and tried to understand, like, what was the links possible. And then I started learning. I mean, this was like during this 3 months process of research. And then I started learning what was needed, like what was needed to build a game. And I realized there was like tremendous different things. You need the game designer, you need a level designer, you need a game economist, you need a game developer, for the game mechanics, you need the backend developer for the like the backend architecture. Then you need to integrate it with blockchain. So you need the Solidity developer, but you need two types of Solidity developers because you need to create a business backend and a business backend that links the game and the blockchain. And then you need to have someone that writes smart contracts. You need to have awesome game artists, and the game, the artists are completely different. Like you have the game artists that have different skills. Then you have the level designer that have different skills of space shaping. And then you have the actual art, another artist that is the sprite, the game sprite artist. And then you have the type of artists that create awesome art, like such as profile pictures and environment pictures, and you kind of an ecosystem. And I just mapped it out. I just mapped the links, and I tried to understand like what was needed in terms of game design documents, because it was the base of the building of the game. So I tried to understand. I read up like lots of design game design documents to understand like what was needed, and yeah, we started really small in the beginning. We were three, and then we grew up to five persons with their network. And then our networks network, and then we started talking to more and more people, and we grew up to a team of eight people. And then when we grew up to a team of eight people, and we started building, because in the beginning we didn't even build on HTML5 on Phaser, we built on Unity, yeah. And when we built on Unity, I mean, for us, we always wanted to build on browser. Like that was my ultimate conviction of the browser, because you want it to be accessible to everyone. So when we figured out that Unity was not possible on browser or Unreal, we pivoted away in January towards Phaser and HTML5. And then Kirill, who was a team member of the six people, was an early member of the Phaser architecture. Then he used his network to increase our team of HTML5 developers. And then it just grew up organically until a size of like 15 people. And then we started hiring. When we built the core of 15 people, then we started like branching out and increasing the skills required per area. Yeah, and now today we're 34 people.
That's nuts. I mean, that's so many people. So yeah, wow. I guess it is the network effects in a sense of, you know, people tapping into their own personal networks and sort of expanding the reach
definitely
of the team. And that's interesting. So yeah, so you know, just on the game engines, because I think this is something that I, you know, have some literacy with, but not a ton just from the dev side. But you know, obviously Phaser being a game engine that runs, you know, on browser, does it have to be browser only, or you know, can it support like an independent client as well?
I'm gonna be honest with you, I don't know if Phaser can support an independent client, but it's not something that we digged into, because I mean, if you want to create an independent client, you just develop on Unreal.
Right,
you're not developing on anything else. Unreal is the most powerful engine where all the AAA games develop. So for us, since the start, the requirement was browser game. Like we need to build something that is browser game that is accessible to everyone. Because one thing that I think lots of projects are missing is that they don't understand who their customer is, who their player is, especially in crypto. Like they're trying to build a super immersive game for crypto people. And not all crypto people are pro gamers. Not all crypto people want to download a 70 gigabyte game on their computer to play it. And not all crypto people want to play just one game. They want interoperability. They want something that is super easy to use. So the majority of those projects, they're building a game, not a platform, just a game for gamers that want an immersive experience. And crypto people just want to have fun. They want to enjoy with their friends. I mean, usually crypto people, the crypto sphere, enjoy on Discord, enjoy on Twitter. I mean, there's no immersive kind of thing. It's just a chat, and it's just like posts, and they're having fun. So.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, what you were saying there actually it really resonates with me and what, you know, the idea of with your friends, right? Because I think that the unique aspect of the NFT space in particular as an expression of Web3 is, you know, the idea of community, right? And we've seen so many projects that end up doing really well simply off the back of, you know, a strong community, a solid community. So I definitely agree with you that I think one of the things that's missing right now that, you know, I like that you guys are sort of, I guess, focusing on is the idea of being able to hop in with other people and like do something, you know, because I think that is, you know, and very easy plug and play, just sort of hop into the game and sort of, you know, be able to do that. And I think that's, you know, a unique proposition that definitely we haven't seen yet for sure.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the first requirements was browser and multiplayer, like, because like the crypto sphere wouldn't be the same without this multiplayer component. Yeah. Everybody hangs out with each other. There's new connections that are created every day. So like the core thinking of this was to create a platform where everybody could hang out and play together. And it really relates to the first feelings that I had when I was 12, 13 years old playing those MMORPGs my friends.
I totally understand that feeling. I mean, the first time I went into World of Warcraft, you know, was like a life-changing moment, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
And I had the same experience, actually, because, you know, recently I picked up, I played WoW Classic for a bit as well myself and sort of got back into the raids. And, you know, it's just the nostalgia just hits you really hard. And I think it's definitely one of those types of experiences where, you know, just being able to get into it and enjoy the social aspect of the games too were great. And, you know, I have close friends who still play and they don't play it actually for, you know, the gameplay so much. They kind of go in and just do some dailies and stuff. But I think the whole, you know, reason they go in is actually because they like the social aspect of it. And I think that's 100%, you know, something that's a little bit untapped. I guess just moving on to the mechanics of how this all works, because I'm just sort of thinking about this now. Like, obviously, I've asked you, you know, a few questions about this on the AMA, and, you know, I'll link down to some of the recorded AMAs that we have on the show notes and stuff. But, you know, one of the questions that I am just sort of thinking of now is sort of how do you, with the whole blockchain integration, I mean, it's exactly like you said, like, there's not really a project that's done this yet. So it's hard to sort of imagine what it looks like, where you have a game that's actually a smooth running game and not like a click to earn, as you like to say. Mm-hmm. You know, how does the whole blockchain element get integrated into that? And, you know, do you have to sort of like stop and you know, approve transactions, pay gas and sort of things like this? And, you know, how do you get around that? Is it like a layer two thing? Is it like a, you know, what's the sort of, what does it look like and how do you guys get around that?
Yeah. So basically the way we innovated on this is instead of, I mean, we saw lots of projects that every time they loot something or just like find something or quest something, they need to approve transactions for every single thing. And it's annoying. It's annoying that it's the worst user experience possible. So the way we did it, the way we're doing it, and then we're going to start testing in June, is basically you go to a place called the darknet. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's the, in our world, you have the nodes, which are the towns, which are hyper-social, multiplayer. I mean, everything is multiplayer, but hyper-social, you can chat, there's different rooms, you can buy buildings, and all that social aspect. And on the other side, you have the darknet. And basically, the darknet is like a place where you go, and you kill monsters. There's like, you can play for 2 hours, 3 hours. And then when you finish with whatever you have done, if you're not dead yet, you can go out of the darknet or your cooldown ends, and then you will do it in one transaction. You will kind of save everything that you have looted from the darknet. Mm-hmm. So it will depend upon you, upon the strategy that you need to choose, because if you die, you have nothing. So everything that you've looted, I mean, you obviously have the fun and stuff, but everything that you have looted is gone. So we kind of bundle all the elements into one transaction. And that's the core thing that we're trying to innovate in our smart contract is the batch minting. to mint multiple objects in one transaction and to have the cheaper fee possible.
That's incredible. Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with you. I think that's one of the issues right now is, you know, having to sign something for, you know, basically every single, like approve every single little transaction. And, you know, I think even just restarting can be a transaction itself. And you see people like having to, you know, self-batch and stuff. And I totally agree with you. I think that kind of, it kills the experience, right? Because I think the whole idea of like, when you imagine playing a game, like if you were in World of Warcraft, and every time you wanted to buy something from a merchant, just like, you know, like a reagent or something for crafting, right? You had to sign a transaction, wait for the blockchain to approve it. I mean, that would just be a terrible experience. You know?
Exactly.
No, I like that. And I think it sort of fits with what you guys have done so far too, in terms of, you know, the overall feel. And I mentioned this to you on one of the AMAs too, like the game, you know, feels quite good, right? And I think that's something that's really important, because if the feeling of moving around and sort of interacting with stuff doesn't feel good, then I think the game kind of just goes to shit off of that alone.
Yeah, you know? And I mean, honestly, you can see the talent of Kirill and Peter on this, because the game demo is not even built on Phaser. It's built on PixieJS. PixieJS is like a drop in the ocean compared to Phaser. And they managed to create something that is so smooth and so cool to play that you don't even feel that hurdle of the architecture. And that's crazy. So you can only imagine how smoother it's going to be in terms of movement and interaction when we pull out the Phaser architecture in the month.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it definitely feels good. And I think that's an interesting thing. So, yeah. Okay. So one other thing that, and this is like maybe a harder question to answer, but I'm more curious to sort of ask like how your approach is to this. Because, you know, I'm also a big gamer, and, you know, I've played a lot of MMORPGs in my time coming up, and spent a lot of time hardcore grinding Dota 2 and Valorant recently, and, you know, lots of different games. And I think the thing for me with any game that, you know, tries to have like an RPG storytelling element and stuff, one of the biggest risks and, you know, difficult things that I think from the dev perspective is just, how do you make a game that's actually fun that people want to play, right? Like, I mean, that's the hardest part, because it could be the smoothest game with the best graphics, best sound design, best world design, all this kind of stuff. But, you know, there's just that sort of almost like intangible aspect to it that makes it not super fun. And I think, you know, obviously there's no right or wrong answer for this, right? But I would be curious to sort of like understand from your perspective coming into this and sort of being like, all right, we're going to make a game. How do you, especially as a gamer yourself, design it such that, you know, it's as fun as possible?
That's an extremely good question. And I think the answer falls into two things. To have something fun, I think you need to be attached to what you're doing. And that attachment comes with the story. And that's why, along with the game, we're writing manga chapters. We already have the manga trailer that is out. And we're going to pull out a manga chapter every 2 weeks at the start, and then every month after that. Because when you're attached to that character, when you're attached to that story, then it makes everything much more powerful.
Sure.
So that's the first component. But as a game design and game development, well, we have hired like Boromir, who was leading the animation of Rayark in Tokyo. It was 200 people. And he have a strong, strong, strong experience in creating compelling game narratives. So when you combine that skill of Boromir that creates amazing things, amazing. I mean, I'm just reading the documents about the quest and I'm having fun reading them, not even playing them.
Yeah, amazing.
So I think it's a mix of talent of someone that is highly skilled, but also when you mix that skill of game narrative with the game storytelling that is written by Squirrel, they work hand in hand. Like they call each other like all day long, and they work hand in hand, but in two different parallels of the story. I mean, the game narrative and the story narrative. So when you combine those, then, I mean, after a work of a few months, then you begin to shape what should the gameplay look like, not the gameplay, what should the game narrative look like, and what should the story look like, and what's the feeling that you want to give to the player. Mm-hmm. And when you understand that feeling that you want to create, to the player, then you're going to try, then what we're doing now is we're going to try different things. And that's where our building philosophy about building and iterating like a startup, because we're a startup, but building and iterating comes into play. We're not going to build like any other game that builds for 2-4 years that thinks he has all the answers. We want to learn from the players, actually. So we have lots of theories about our game narrative, about our quests, hard quests, easy quests, fun gameplay of killing the monster, fun game mechanics. We have lots of theory. And in June, that's where the beta version comes in. There's not going to be any blockchain component. There's not going to be any coin component or anything. It's just going to be like the fun in itself. And then we're going to introduce all the theories that we have, and we're going to collect the data from the players, and we're going to understand what they like, what they don't like. We're going to collect all the feedback and understand how we can shape a better gameplay and a better experience for everybody. And it's going to take, in my opinion, two, three months to understand that feedback. And still, it's never going to finish. Like, you always need to learn from the user's behavior. So during this testing phase is going to be crucial to the game, because we're going to then shape up the better game narrative and the better gameplay, and that is curated for these players. And then we're going to build a way stronger core in September. We're going to put out the first version, actually, of the game with the coin, with the exchange, with the NFT items that you can craft and all that stuff, based on all the data that we have recolled, and the game narrative and story that we have pulled out. And we start from there, and we get to learn a lot about what the players like and don't like, and then evolve from there.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good answer. I mean, you can't guarantee any of this stuff, right? So I think being responsive and sort of, you know, testing with your core demographic seems to make a lot of sense to me. And I think, you know, that definitely makes a lot of sense. You know, it gets me thinking too, like, when you think about games these days, like, a lot of times when they get people really riled up to play, like, you know, one of the games that I mentioned earlier, you know, Valorant and stuff, me getting into that game and that whole ecosystem and you know, I guess Riot Games, you know, treatment of you know, how they treat their customers, if you will, you know, they do a lot of content, and it's fantastic, because I really do think, like, you know, having come from Dota 2 and never really playing League of Legends, you know, I finally understand now why people are so diehard about it, right? Because the culture and sort of everything they've made in that sort of whole ecosystem in terms of content is just exceptional. So I'm curious if you guys have considered, you know, all other forms, like with, you know, video and stuff, as opposed to manga, just for, I guess, like a slightly more immersive, you know, experience as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you can see already on our Twitter, like, we have one animator that is working on short snippets. There's like 7 or 8 videos that we've put out of 7 to 10 seconds of animation of our character. So we're thinking about animation too. The problem about animation is it's a lot of work, lots of time, and lots of energy. And for now, we're not focusing on that, because it's not the priority. But later on, we definitely love to create animation on top of that. And then we're gonna also have the Twitch streamers that we already have in contact, like Voidboy of League of Legends, who is an investor with us, and we have Mo also, who is big on League of Legends. Like, we are in contact with the biggest Twitch streamers in the world, and then we're gonna create content with them. Like, we're gonna try to be multi-channel in terms of content, to create a whole ecosystem around the story, around the game, around like animations and all that stuff. Yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. No, I love that, because I do think now, you know, again, after entering that ecosystem and being exposed to all that, I just realized, like, oh my God, you know, like, this content really kind of gets you fired up as hell. But at the same time, I agree with the approach. I think, you know, you don't want to do everything under the sun when it's not the objective in a way. Like, I think it's important to stay focused on, you know, what's right ahead and not really getting too ahead of oneself. So I do agree with that for sure.
Yeah.
And on that, so it's interesting because, you know, you mentioned before also that you guys have been, you know, you've acquired VC funding for this. You obviously put in a good amount of money yourself from, you know, the startup that you managed to exit by selling and stuff. So I was wondering, you know, why time the mint for now? What's sort of the, you know, objective of that? Is that, you know, there are two considerations that I sort of see whenever it comes to a mint kind of situation, right? One is obviously it's a fundraise because you'll be, you know, taking the proceeds from the actual mint, and, you know, any royalties that come through, and that sort of goes back into the development of whatever you're doing. The other thing is obviously to onboard people, but in a sense, you know, once you get the community involved and invested, then in a sense, it's almost like going public, right? Where with a company where, you know, there's a lot more scrutiny, and I think a lot of people are sort of, you know, watching what you do very closely in a sense. So I'm curious of, you know, the decisions behind why put your mint now, or, you know, in the coming week or two, when your game is not slated to come out until September.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, the game is going to start in June. Mm-hmm. The game is not going to start in September. Like the coin is going to start in September. The game is going to start in June. So basically, our thought process is that the NFTs, this profile picture, is your in-game character. And basically, you need that to play the gameplay. Mm-hmm. Without them, you cannot play the game. You cannot play the role-playing game. So this is the first step, this profile pictures, because right after, 2 or 3 weeks afterwards, you're going to have the in-game characters that you can walk around in the game demo in. And then you're going to experience with them the new building, the new build on Phaser architecture 2 weeks afterwards. And then we're going to drop the core architecture of the gameplay with the combat mechanics, with the monsters, with two maps on top, and before NFT NYC in June. And so basically these NFTs that we're going to mint in approximately 10 days are your access to the role-playing game. And it's with that we're going to learn from the players to create an awesome gameplay. So it's your first gated access. And then we're going to also introduce the breeding to increase the population of Ronin. And so we give them a first opportunity to start doing the quest to be able to breed the Ronin and increase the population of Ronin slowly. Basically, it allows us to grow our user base from the start, reaching out to September, when we're going to be more mature. And then in September, when the coin comes and the exchange comes and everything, there's going to be more Ronin around. And with those more Ronin around, I mean, everything just starts. But it's like the testers are the ones who get the NFTs right now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So yeah, I guess the full sort of experience with the coin, all that kind of stuff comes in September, but the game itself will be, you know, rolling out soon enough. So that makes sense. Yeah, I guess that's, yeah, it's fascinating, man. So about you, you know, because I think your approach to stuff, and this is kind of, I think, why we get along in many respects, right? But I think your approach to a lot of this stuff has been, you know, lots of transparency. You obviously write a lot of things, you know, for Ragnarok on the Medium. And, you know, you yourself have been quite outspoken about transparency and quality and sort of, I guess, your ethos towards building. So, you know, I'm curious what sort of spurred that, because obviously I have thoughts on this too. And, you know, I try to sort of have a high ethical sort of standard for things in this space where it sometimes feels like people don't really care about that so much. So I'm curious sort of how you formed that opinion and sort of, you know, what your thoughts are on the space as a whole.
I mean, as a whole, as a person, as my values, as what I believe in, like even not even speaking about the project, I try to be a very honest person and a very transparent person with the people around me, that's who I am. With my friends and girlfriend and family, I try to be a really easygoing person, and I say what I think, right? And I don't try to hide things or anything. And so it's not something that I decided for this space. Like even with my previous companies or in school, in university, whatnot, I always was super transparent. And I write a lot, but for myself, in notebooks about my days, my thoughts, trying to understand better my thoughts, because I found out that writing things allows you to clear up your thoughts and even try to understand better your own thoughts. And so, I mean, when I came into the space of Web3, I figured out that there was a lot of hype building and there was not much people that was actually building the stuff that was being said. So I thought that this, I didn't even think about it. I just like went with it. It wasn't a thought process. It was more of like, it's the natural thing to do for me.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I agree with that. Because yeah. I think it's sort of, that was the same exact thing for me too, like writing content. And sometimes it kind of blows my mind because I get these messages from people being like, oh, you know, it's so nice that you're, you know, transparent or, you know, disclosing things. And I'm kind of just like, man, this shit should be the standard, right? I mean, like it's shocking to me that people, you know, it's shocking to me that this is still something that is so uncommon in this space for people to like, you know, disclose their affiliations and disclose, you know, their conflicts of potential conflicts of interest and stuff. And yeah. I think it just shows, you know, we are at this interesting crossroads, right? Where, and this is kind of how I see it, but we're at this crossroads where, you know, we can either, improve as a whole and sort of drive the space forward with, you know, better ethics and better accountability and stuff, or we kind of just go to shit, you know, with people, you know, going down the spiral of you know, these unethical behaviors and stuff. And so I do, you know, resonate very much. I do sort of think that we do need to, you know, get more people in the space who are willing to sort of be very transparent about all this kind of stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And completely agree with you, because it's upon us to make the space a better place, because right now, like the space, I mean, doesn't have a really good reputation, right? Yeah. Scammers, rugs, like it's the Wild West, and it's upon a few people, I believe, that are in it for the long term, and not for the quick buck. Like for me personally, like I don't need, I'm well in terms of financial, of the financial aspect. So I don't need that spur of making like quick money. Like I want to get rich. So I don't need that. And because I don't need that, I want to grow as a person, because I think reputation is extremely important as a person. Like it's way more important than wealth. Reputation is everything. And so it's upon us and it's upon the people that want to grow as person and that want to make things grow in general, to create something more ethical and more more honest.
Yeah, and, I totally agree. I totally agree. And sorry to cut you off there, but I totally agree with that, because I do think that, you know, people are exactly as you said, like they want to take the quick payout, and it's very difficult, right? Because there are a lot of ways to make money in this space, and unfortunately, a lot of them, you know, require people to kind of sacrifice their morals a bit, you know. And I've spoken about this before, but you know, I get a lot of you know, people in my DMs asking me like what my rates are for a shill, and I'm just like, damn, like it's
yeah, know, I begin to receive those kind of messages too.
Yeah, and it's just like, holy shit, you know, like it just makes you think, like, how many people out there in this space are just taking these offers and sort of, you know, shielding stuff without disclosures, and you know, there's just this complete lack of transparency in a sense, right? But I fully agree with you, and I've said it before.
It's not even transparency, it's it's honesty.
Yes.
There's a huge lack of honesty.
I agree.
It's striking, and you're completely right about this. But yeah, I mean, it's how the world works, right? I mean, you cannot have everybody who's honest, and I mean, we're not living with rainbows and unicorns, right? I mean, there's different people, and
for sure, yeah. It's true. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, but I think the important thing is we sometimes lose sight of the bigger picture, as you said. And I think, you know, if you're here for the long haul and, you know, if you really believe in the underlying technology and stuff, then I think we have to be part of the change we want to see, right? And I think, you know, I'm quite taken by the way that you've run your project. And, you know, just because, again, you're making everything available and sort of trying to disclose as much as possible to people. And I think, you know, notwithstanding like anything that happens with respect to, you know, how the project goes and sort of, you know, how things, you know, end up working out in practice, you know, I think you've set a good precedent of, you know, the adequate level of disclosures that a project founder should be giving to people in terms of, you know, what goes on. And I hope, you know, other content creators sort of will start to be more transparent as well, like with this kind of stuff that I'm sharing too, because I really do think that, you know, it has to be kind of like a grassroots movement, right? And I'm sure you must get like interesting feedback from people too when you sort of mention to them in your personal life that you're that this is what you're doing. I mean, I don't know if you've had that conversation with a lot of people or not.
Yeah, I did. All my close friends know what I'm doing. My family knows, and I mean, they thought I was crazy in the beginning. I was telling them, I'm gonna do a game in blockchain. They were like, "Nah, get the fuck out of here." and yeah, I was like, "Yeah, no, I'm gonna do it." And then yeah, I'm trying to do it. And in the beginning, like, it was really hard because. And no one has built any game in my environment, like a strong game or strong blockchain project or anything. My friends are developers, but they didn't build something from scratch. I don't know if it was possible. When I told them, yeah, I'm going to build a blockchain game. And when I even told them like an MMORPG on browser combined with blockchain, it's going to be a social network. They were like, what did you smoke, man? what did you smoke? Like, but yeah, I think it's, and you got to be crazy sometimes.
No, I agree. I think you have to, I mean, progress only really comes when you do something that no one else is really thinking about doing or no one else has the balls to do, right? So I fully agree with that. And I think, you know, that truly is the way forward, you know? And it's one of those things too, right? And I think going back to the previous point of sometimes you just keep doing the thing that, you know, you're doing and eventually it all comes together and then you become an overnight success after, you know, 5 years of hard work, right? You know, it's one
of those. Exactly. I mean, this there's two things. Like, there's this this willingness of the fear, because lots of people have a fear of starting something because of the fear of failure. Yeah. And I mean, I don't need money. Because I don't need money, there's not a fear of me failing and then everything just falls into shambles. And I was like, yeah, I can try. And if it doesn't work after, I gave myself like 4 or 5 months in the beginning. Yeah. And if it doesn't work, then that's fine. I would have learned a lot of stuff about the space and that's cool. And then when I put my money into it, I was like, yeah, even if I lose this, like, I mean, it's not a big deal. And then I was like, just willing to put yourself out there and try whatever is possible. And the second thing is, I forgot what I wanted to say.
Yeah. Well, I'll comment on the first thing. I mean, I agree with that too. And I think that, you know, the financial thing is definitely a consideration. And, you know, I've talked to people about my own situation and, you know, I've told people that I've left my job as a lawyer. And, you know, I've been working on some stuff. I think personal projects that are a little bit, you know, unrelated to Web3, but also have been working obviously on the things that I'm doing Web3 and content creation and, you know, with this podcast and Twitter and stuff. And, you know, I often say to people, like, the financials are a very important consideration. I think a lot of people, you know, who are traders and stuff, you know, end up making a couple ETH profit or, you know, even if they're holding on like pretty good bags, right? And they kind of just are like, all right, I can leave my job now. And without really thinking like, how long can I go for without needing any income? Like, what if none of my trades work out? What if I lose half my portfolio value? Like, you know, these are all considerations that I think are really important to make, you know, just from the trader perspective. Right. And as a result of not really thinking about that, I think some people do feel the financial pressure after some time, and then they have to take the way out of, you know, shit, I don't have anything to do. I don't have any income. I guess I have to take this offer to shill something, or I guess I have to do, you know, this advisory job for this shitty project that I don't really want to be involved with and stuff, you know? And I think that's the unfortunate circumstance. So I definitely think, you know, some planning and some, you know, thinking about like your finances and how long you can go for really is definitely super important, you know?
It is, but the big advantage of this space is like money has become a commodity in this space. It's pretty easy for anybody who wants to build something to raise money. It's pretty easy for you to get a good salary out of what you're building in this space. And it's a space that is evolving at a rate that is the same as the web space in the 90s. It's evolving so fast that there's so much opportunities to make. And and the only thing that I think people have lost sight of is just the long-term view versus the short-term, I want to make a quick buck.
Yeah.
And if you think more about giving yourself a chance for, I don't know, like 1 year or 2 years in this space, you're going to make it.
Yeah.
Like there's no way, unless you put out like 100 times leverage, you're a degen, you get fucked. But there's no way that if you work hard, whether it's in trading or even if you want to become a social media influencer, an influencer in the space or whatever, even if you're disclosing things, there's no way that if you work hard in the space for 1 year or 2 years that you're not going to make it. No way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I guess it looks different from either perspective, but I do agree with you that there's a ton of opportunities that are out here. And I think if people go about it the right way, then, you know, it's very, there definitely is a path forward. And I think that obviously is predicated on the fact that, you know, we all believe in this technology. We all believe in the use cases for this. And, you know, as a result of that, investing in the space generally is sort of, you know, something that can yield massive rewards. Because I agree with you. I mean, the amount of money flowing into the space and the amount of opportunity I think that there still is really quite something, you know? And by contrast, I think if I think back to my own, you know, the stuff that I do, you know, if I'm just writing content that's not really, you know, relating to Web3, there's just so many people doing the same thing, like, you know, with respect to either like investments or even just like looking at the broader, you know, macro sort of how projects or companies are performing and what they're doing and stuff, you know, there's just so much competition for other people doing that. And, you know, here, there's just not enough of that content, you know?
Exactly. And it's the same. I mean, you speak about content creation and it's the same for businesses. Like building a business in Web2 or even in physical is 100 times harder than building a business on Web3. Like the competition and the barriers to entry are so much higher than anything in this space. And even the scaling, like in the Web3 space, the scale is infinite quite quickly. And and in the Web2 space, and if you sell digital goods, physical goods, sorry, it's way harder to scale. And if you go into the physical, purely physical, it's extremely even more hard to scale. So building in this space is building in, I mean, compared to real life is university versus playground. And it's the same, I suppose, for content creation, because there's not enough competition for you as a content creator, as a content writer, to compete with. Like you can, with good skills, you don't need to be excellent, but with great skills, you're already like on top of the majority.
No, I think that's right. And I think, you know, the flip side of that, just thinking about it out loud, the flip side of that is, you know, again, the sort of risks of it, right? Which because there's so much opportunity, there's no barrier to entry. And a lot of bad actors can go through too, you know? And so you get project founders that are, you know, just trying to rug or you know, creating basically vaporware. And you get, you know, content creators or you know, I say this with the biggest air quotes possible, but influencers, you know, who try to come onto the space and basically all they want to do is like, you know, shill projects, get paid to sort of like, you know, massive following and just sort of shill stuff to people. And I, you know, I think it's a double-edged sword for that reason. So definitely, I mean, I think, yeah, lots of opportunity, lots of risks. And that's, you know, coming back to the same idea, like, I think that's kind of why we're at this turning point where we could go either way. We could go, you know, and build out this amazing space that's very welcoming, that actually has like some of the best and most positive vibes that, you know, a lot of people have experienced. Or we could, you know, go the other way and just get consumed by greed and sort of, you know, go down that path. But certainly, you know, I try to do my part with the content that I put out, and I try to sort of, you know, set an example for, you know, we should democratize knowledge. We should, you know, let people be aware of like these obvious scams and obvious bullshit that goes on, and sort of have some basic literacy of how to read, you know, the markets. Basically, if you're really here to trade, you know, then by all means go for it, but, you know, do it the right way and try to be smart about it and stuff.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think we're like in the gold rush, and it's the same as in for the gold itself, but also in the web space in the 90s, where everybody was rushing to build things and everything was super inflated, and it was just crazy. It's the Wild West. Everything is competing and everything is telling promises, and it's kind of crazy. And at the end of the day, some people are going to come out of it extremely strong.
Absolutely. Brett Fanfaron, let me tell you, man, we've had very similar thoughts, you know, because I was literally explaining this just yesterday. I was talking to my wife and I said, you know, we're literally in the gold rush right now, right? Because back then, when you look at the price of everything too, it's just so inflated. Like, yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, I think that there is a bubble burst coming, because there's no way that the prices can sort of stay at where they are for a lot of the products on the market right now. And, you know, I think a lot of it is just a lot of crypto money and people who bought really early. And so maybe they have a lot of liquidity, but I think if there is any wide scale adoption of this, this bubble has to burst, because this just doesn't make any sense anymore of some of these valuations. Right. But it's exactly like you said, it's like the gold rush. And, you know, back then people were sort of panning for gold, and, you know, a barrel of flour would cost them like $100, which I think by today's value would be like, you know, several thousand or something. You know, and it's just, you know, everything's inflated. Everything is so expensive. And we kind of think about things in ETH terms now. And it's like, oh, that's just 0.1. That's not bad. It's like, dude, that's $300. Yeah. You know, it's like a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, everything is super inflated. But it's not only in crypto space, in the world in general. Like, if you don't see a problem in the world right now, there is a problem. Like, there is a problem today of everything being, I mean, because of the money printing and everything that happened in the last 2 years, there's a fucking bubble. I mean, there's a social problem. And the big problem is that the rich got richer, and the medium people got poorer. And the poor, I mean, let's not even talk about them, because their situation right now is catastrophic.
Absolutely.
So, there's either going to be a social revolt, because I was seeing the prices of a can of Coke at the supermarket, and I was like, damn, it's 1 euro. Mm-hmm. And just a few years back, I mean, you don't even realize these things, but just a few years back, it was like 50 cents.
Yeah.
And you're like, damn. I mean, and you see the salaries didn't double, and yeah, there's a problem. There's a problem in the world, and the bubble needs to burst, or there's going to be a social revolt.
No, I tend to agree, and I think it's an unfortunate situation that we're in, seeing things, you know, all inflated like this. But I think it all comes down to, you know, again, a lot of opportunity for greed and people to sort of cash grab and stuff, and without being too, I guess, you know, doomsday sort of predicting.
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah.
You know, because I tend to agree with you, but I think, you know, the positive spin on it, I guess, or the hopeful spin is that, you know, at the same time, I think with anything that's ever happened in this kind of way, where things are overinflated and there's a bubble to be burst, you know, I think that there is a lot of opportunity that comes out of these types of things as well. And so I think, you know, again, same thing, like what you're doing, I have a lot of respect for. And I think, you know, you will lead the way for a lot of projects, at the minimum, in terms of the approach that they should take towards building things and the approach that they should take towards this new Web3 space that we're in, where, you know, because you're fundraising from a crowdsourced manner at a very early stage, you know, the utmost level of transparency should be given to everybody, you know, and everybody yeah. should see what's going on. And
yes,
I think that's a really good precedent that you guys are setting. And it'd be interesting to sort of see you, I guess, more involved with, you know, mentoring other project founders as they come forward and sort of, you know, helping to build out the ecosystem with this way, because I really do think this is the way forward.
Yeah, I mean, the main difference also about Web3 that is really different from Web2, for the first time ever, the player, the user, is also the investor. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I raised VC money before, and you need to have transparency with your VCs, right? Yeah. You need to tell them what's going on, even if they're not good or bad or good or great. Like, you need to give them updates mm-hmm. of, like, yeah, guys, this is my problems. This is where I'm going. This is the good things. This is the good news. This is the bad news. And you yeah. need to have transparency towards them. And right sure. now, the players, the users, the community is also the people who put money into the project to make it grow. So they're a part of it. And mm-hmm. it's our duty to give those people who are putting money into our project to tell them, all right, this is what's up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I fully agree with that. And I think, you know, again, I think we see eye to eye on a lot of things. And I totally agree with you. I think the analogy is 100% there. I did have one more question, though, about yes. this. And this is, you know, I think you touched on this before, but with respect to getting VC investment for your project, I mean, you know, we have mm-hmm. seen a lot of money come in. I was curious as to, you know, how you went about that process. And were you looking for, you know, a strategic VC? Because a lot of yeah. people, you know, obviously coming from the traditional M&A sphere, you know, I was often advising clients on things. And one of the biggest commercial decisions was, you know, we want to pick a VC that really makes sense with our objectives and what we're trying to do as a strategic partner. Whereas, you know, from my personal experience, I've seen a lot of VCs that want to put money into the Web3 space, but maybe aren't really Web3 native, or, you know, don't really have yep. any real idea of what's going on. And I think that's theoretically possible to do something with those kind of people, but I'm always just a little bit concerned as to, you know, how that might look.
Yep.
And I'll give you a personal story about this too, but, you know, a friend of mine went to work for, you know, very Web2 company, not at all Web3 native. And, you know, they kind of were trying to put into place some, you know, systems, and they never, no one in the company had ever transacted on a wallet before. So they had literally yeah. no idea how any of this worked. And, you know, for me, that just sort of feels like there's this huge disconnect, right? Where some investors want exposure, but they have no idea what it looks like. They just want to be like, okay, I want a part of this space. Whereas yeah. some others are a lot more, you know, Web3 native integrated, like understand it. So I was curious, like, what that process was like for you.
So it's simple. We didn't take any VC money. We took like every month, all the money that we took was from people that are deep in the space.
Uh-huh,
like we have okay. SatStart, we have Cold Bullet Schiller, we have the DFK DAO, we have Mackie from Sushi. Like we have only people who are deep in this space and who have usually product founders or yeah. people who are notable in public on Twitter about who they are. That's the vast majority of, it's like 80% of our fundraise. And then we took two VC money, small checks with Spartan Group, mm-hmm. Who is a Web3 native, and the Blizzard Fund. And the Blizzard Fund is basically the fund of Avalanche, which is a blockchain company.
Yeah.
So this is the only two VCs that we took, but the remaining are all Web3
individuals.
People.
Yeah.
Individuals. So because we needed them for the network, their understanding of the market and everything, because we sure. didn't found, because every single investor, people that has invested in the seed round is helping us a lot. Mm-hmm. Like their value in terms of help is 1,000 times bigger than any of the money they have put into it. Like that yeah. was the only condition that we wanted is any person that comes in needs to help us go to the new level. And yeah. And they all did their job. Like I cannot thank them enough. And I think there's in Web3 right now, there's a big opposition to VCs and to the early investors because of what happened in the Solana ecosystem, where the VCs owned 90% of the round, 95% of the round, and then the community only 5%, and then the VCs dump on them, and yeah, there's a bad view on VC money, and that's where our role as a founder is to find the balance between the community and the VCs. Because usually in those projects where there's a bad reputation, it's usually like 95% VCs and 5% community. For us, it's 25% the VCs and 75% the community in terms of investment. So the balance is reversed completely. But you cannot have 100% the community. It's not it doesn't work. It doesn't work because you need the investors' relationship. And investors opens you doors that are not possible with the community. And as a project, you need them both. You need them both.
Absolutely. And I think that's the strategic element, right? It's like, you know, having these key people that maybe have, you know, deep pockets, but aside from just having deep pockets, able, you know, sort of make you able to access, you know, new markets, new verticals, or, you know, even just using their own networks and stuff. So yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that's absolutely right. Cool. Well, man, we could do this all day, but you know, we're past the hour now, so we can let's wrap this up. But do you have anything else you wanted to add? And you know, before we round up,
no, honestly, it was good speaking to you. Like, it's super interesting questions that I rarely have from people. So it shows your interest really in the space, and I'm super happy we have connected. So deeply grateful.
I me too, man. And, you know, I really appreciate you reaching out and sort of, you know, I think it's start of many things to come. But, you know, I definitely appreciate being connected with people like yourself who, you know, view this whole process, I think, you know, with integrity and with a very different lens from what we see, you know, elsewhere in the space. So, you know, I definitely, the respect is very much mutual. Awesome. Yeah, brother. All right. Well, why don't you tell people where they can find you, your socials and sort of anything?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, you can find us on Twitter. It's Ragnarok Meta. And you can join, you cannot join our Discord anymore. We're going to close it this week because the minting is approaching soon. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you can find us on Twitter and at Ragnarok Meta, and find me on Twitter at 0xFunFan. And yeah, you can send me DMs, and I'm super open to answering people on Twitter.
Awesome, man. And we'll link to all of that in the show notes as well, in the newsletter that goes out with it. So thank you very much again for your time, brother. And looking forward to next time we speak.
Yeah, thank you, Airport. Thanks for this.
All right, appreciate you, man. Thanks for having me.